Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is a forum. Today's session number is 2001-16 and is titled Stories of Reconciliation. Let's listen in.
I'm here this night. And this Monday night, in our conversation, one thing led to the next, and we decided to share some three stories of reconciliation, and then just open it up and let anyone who feels moved to share their own stories of reconciliation, with the hope that just the stories themselves will inspire us in our faith walk. And I'm the moderator. And what that job is on Thursday nights is that we have, come on in and find a seat. We have exactly 1 hour because at 10 o'clock the Compline service is in this room. And we, as we were talking, we thought that was really great. So that shortly before that time, we'll end our discussion, and those who want to can leave. And those who want to stay can just stay put, and we'll move right from our discussion of stories of reconciliation into the Compline service, which is a very quiet prayer service, bringing the day to an end. And so I will watch the time and make sure that a few minutes before closing time, we'll be aware of that. One thing to remember, this wonderful reminder right here, that on your way out, if you have an ice cream dish, just put it up in the dish pit window on your way to bed. And probably the Compline service doesn't want to worship the ice cream boat.
If it was full, that'd be worse.
That's true. And Callista, the head of the kitchen, has been known to say when the ice cream shipment doesn't come on the boat, she's been, and there's so much complaining, she's been known to say, ice cream is God at Holden Village. So, the other two just little things that we agreed I'd say as moderator is that as we share our own personal stories of reconciliation, that we want to tell our story completely and at the same time be mindful that we do only have an hour, and we want to give as many people as possible an opportunity to share their stories. So be mindful of the time as you share. The second thing was just making an agreement ahead of time that silence is okay. We don't need to be afraid of silence. And often the most appropriate response to a deep story is just to sit quietly with it for a while and let it rest in our souls. And the third and final guideline for this evening is we're just going to share our stories. We're not going to analyze them. The person sharing his or her story is not doing that for you to give them advice or tell them what they should have done or shouldn't have done, but rather just to hear. So, as they say in 12-step meetings, we won't have any crosstalk. We'll just offer our stories sort of like a prayer. Sit with them quietly, and if you feel moved, tell your story. And we've got three people to start us off, and then we'll just move into that. Charles Manti, who's been serving as our spiritual director for 3 weeks and is soon leaving us. Ray McKeever, whose music we've been enjoying today, this week. And Catherine Cummings Bond, who has been bringing us great women in history. So, whoever would like to begin may, and after these three have shared, we'll all share.
Okay.
My story is really one of a process that's continuing in reconciliation, and it's amazingly how close it was to Mike's sharing this evening on compassion for the earth. I was kind of listening to myself in that, in his presentation. I'm a spiritual director, and so this, for me, the spiritual journey or the inner journey is a very important piece of my life. And in that process, what often happens is things are uncovered that I see about myself that need to be kind of opened up to God. Oftentimes, I see myself as in places where I have pride or arrogance in certain areas. And this summer, for some reason, I've been led in my own personal retreat time at Nestucca Sanctuary on the Oregon coast, and at other in other prayer times, to begin to recognize something in me that in which I need reconciliation, and that's a sense of my own pride and arrogance in connection with the earth. That I walk through nature without really noticing nature, as if I am above nature, as if somehow I am privileged above all that is around me, that is literally shouting glories and praise to God, and my ears are deaf to it. So my story is really a story of coming to grips with that pride, with that arrogance, and desiring a reconciliation with nature, reconciliation in my own heart with the earth around me. And Holden Village certainly has been a place where that struggle has continued. And I think we'll continue for some time before there is some kind of resolution. That's my story.
Well, I believe that in our lives, we do not get preparation for what's truly important. We go to school and some of us go to college and declare a major, and not that business isn't important or whatever. Mine was interior design and religion was my major, which is very important. But in terms of what's truly important, I think learning how to love a person is truly important, and I never took any classes on that. I think being a parent is an important part of life. We never took any classes on that. And then I think the two other things that are vitally important in life and no one ever taught us was forgiveness and reconciliation. For a couple years I was a hospice chaplain, and that means that I have the privilege of walking with people, and in my case it was 178 families, through death. And what I learned from walking with families and having the sacred opportunity of, you know, I know them not at all, and I walk into their home and I ask them how they're feeling about dying or how they're feeling about their loved one dying. So you kind of go from all the awkwardness to cutting to the chase. And what I learned about reconciliation was that unless you do it in life, you face death, and you really can't die until you do it. My experience was with those 178 families was that most people had reconciled with God in whatever form. And when I prayed with them, I said, "What do you call God?" And whatever they called God, I would pray to that God, because I wasn't trying to lay my Christian faith onto them. One woman wouldn't die. She just wouldn't die. We talked about her at our team meeting every Tuesday, and she just wasn't going to die. Turned out there had been abuse. She'd abused one of her daughters. And she'd never reconcile. The daughter had been seeing a therapist for 6 years about this about this horrible experience with her mom. And so she'd done her own work. She'd reconciled her half of it. It did take 6 years. It was really expensive. Unequivocally, the most important work she ever did was that. But her mom just wouldn't die. And she also wouldn't talk about it. So that's a bit of a warning that if we don't do our work now, we will face death, and you know, you just got to do it. And I saw that was one example. But the story I want to tell, I was more of an observer than the subject of this reconciliation. I work in a ministry, it's called the Ministry of Reconciliation, that helps people work through coming out issues and reconciling with God about their orientation, reconciling with themselves, reconciling with the church, which often the church doesn't want to reconcile. And I want to tell you about one situation, one family. This is a lovely family, man and wife, and Ron had been gay his entire life. His wife knew. They talked about it. And before the woman came to clean the house, she would put all the gay books away, hide them before they went to work. And so Ron finally said, "Enough. I can't play this game anymore." And so he decided to come out and came to my ministry and met me. And he was an upstanding citizen and an elder in his Presbyterian church. And his wife was a lovely woman. Well, the next year was rocky for them, but I spent a lot of time, particularly with the woman, the wife, and we went through a lot of wine, and she cried a lot of tears about her whole image of a family, and then when she was done really working through issues, she became very active in the ministry that's for gay, lesbian, bi, trans folks. She's now the organist, and she tied. It's an important place for her. But when they got done with this year of work, they did a service of reconciliation and divorce that was, for me, the most powerful worship service I've ever been a part of. We came, and Gwen wrote the whole service. She's very articulate. She's a lay woman, but incredibly articulate. And they gave each other vows for the rest of their lives, faced each other. They have two boys. One boy thought this was stupid and wouldn't come. The other young man was there, both in their 20s. And the vows were gorgeous, amazing, to think these people are divorcing, and there was the added complication of the whole gay issue. And then they, you know how in a wedding you light two candles to one? They lit one candle to two. Mm-hmm. And being that Ron was the gay man, he had put on the altar all these amazing candles, about 130 of them. Or they were gorgeous the way he'd done it, the fabric and stuff. And they said, "If you have anything in your life you'd like to reconcile, maybe you'd like to come forward and light a candle too." Well, There, I don't remember a word spoken, but there were about 150 people there. Every single person came forward and got the light from Gwen or Ron, who'd just done this amazing public presentation. When you think of divorce, you don't think of services like this. But in many of our worship books, there are services like this. So it's a possibility. It can be done. Well, I am divorced, and my children's father, there's some real lack of reconciliation. He hasn't spoken to me in 10 years. But my daughter, who's up here this week, said, wept the whole way through the service. And she said, "Mom, if we could have done something like this, it would have helped me so much." And I said, "Honey, it would have helped all of us so much." But I love that image of reconciliation through divorce, that it can be done, and that it can be done in love.
When we met, I want to preface my story with just telling you that when we met as a staff, teaching staff the other night, most of us for the first time, we said our names, where we were from, and then Dan asked us to address the question of something like, tell of an instance where God was very present in your life. So I'm just giving you that as a little, if you ever want to find a way to find out some things about people, that'll probably have to do with reconciliation or whatever. I believe most of the stories had to do with somehow the way God came into our life and shifted things a little bit. I don't know what it means to experience God, but I think that's kind of how it came out, is that God, somehow the reconciliation or some new perspective took place. The story that I told in response to that question was usually when, at first when I thought of the question, I thought, a certain moment, you know, just a certain moment in time where it happened. And all of a sudden I thought, no, it happened over a longer period. And it was nice to think of just a period of time when God was present and kind of just guiding things and in a kind of a creative way. And then I could leave and I said, wow, God was present then. And it was a time when I came up to Holden Village about 9 years ago, 8 years ago now. And I came up here for 3 weeks. I had been here many times before, but this time was different because I brought along the ashes of my wife who had died the year before, right at that time. And one of the things that we had talked about as she was dying was her funeral, and we planned a memorial service, and all that. We talked about where her ashes would be put. So I brought her ashes with me, and while she was in the process of dying from her cancer, going through a remission, experiencing again, during her remission, 10 months before that, she had come up to Holden by herself after we'd been here many times together, and hiked up the Copper Basin. And that was really important to her, that she was able to do that hike, make it up there. So we talked about, after she died, taking her ashes up there. So I came back to Holden that time, and I brought her ashes with me, and on the date of her death, the exactly 1 year anniversary, put her ashes in her hiking boots and slung them over my shoulder. And went up to Copper Basin with the tent and stayed the night up there and found a beautiful spot to put them in on that day. A week later, and I didn't know this was going to happen exactly like this at all. I kind of planned that earlier on. I brought our rings with us, and a week later, actually a little bit longer than a week later, on the anniversary of our marriage, September 7th, I went up to Holden Lake, and there somehow a ritual evolved as I was writing and just sitting there with these rings, and I tied the rings together, these beautiful gold rings that may have come from this valley, from this mine, who knows, and wrapped them up with some grass and flung them out in the middle of Holden Lake. They were reconciling experiences for me in a way, because they embraced the reality of what had happened, and but I think even more important, helped me make a creative choice about what to do with some of the important symbols. But I think even as I was telling the story the other night, I thought even more important, I think, was the fact that when I came up for that three-week period, many people at Holden knew that that was my journey then, and I was able to share that with people here. And I've forgotten a lot of what happened then, although as I talk about it, I can remember a lot more. So maybe that's the gift of doing some kind of reconciliation action. But one thing I did remember as I was talking the other night was that while I was here, I did a concert. And some of the concert had to do certainly with this experience, what was going on in my reflections and poetry and some songs. But while I was here, there was a man here from the Portland Symphony, a very gifted clarinetist. And he offered to play a song at this concert, and it was a song from La Boheme. Some of you may know, it's just a right there. And he was a great accompanist and was playing this song. And he got about halfway through it, and he stopped. He couldn't do it. And I'll never forget that, because in some ways it helped to release something in me that I couldn't release myself. A certain kind of just choking up and tears and all the rest. And it was just there in him. And he started up again and stopped again. And he did that a couple, three times, and finally moved on through it. But, I don't know, it was the connections that I made, I think, with people and the way people helped me express them.
My two children, they're 29 and 27. Their dad and I divorced when I was 6 months pregnant with the youngest one. We thought we were being friendly, but as the years passed, it was not friendly at all. Very, very ugly. He went through several marriages. Made promises to the boys that he didn't keep. Couldn't take them for the vacation because he didn't want to have to hire a babysitter. Things like that, you know. And the child support, he said, all went to the babysitter. Then he quit paying child support. And it just kept getting uglier between us and uglier. And his parents are Christians. We stayed in contact. And over the last 4 years or so, there's really been a healing process. My oldest graduated cum laude from Ellensburg with a Bachelor of Music degree in June. And that day we were all together. My present spouse, him and his present spouse, both boys, my mom, my brother, his brother, who he hadn't spoken to in a long time, the graduation of our son from college was kind of like a reconciliation. It brought all of us together, and we all hugged, and we all felt love. And I couldn't honestly say, you know, to him, I love you. I'll always love you. I'm not in love you, with you. And he said he cared too. And we both knew where we were coming from. And after over 27 years, we've now come to a very friendly, peaceful place of reconciliation, and it's been through the children.
I'd like to tell a story that I think is kind of a happy reconciliation of my parents. When I was a child, we didn't get along very well. And my mother said to me, I don't know how many times, you know, your dad has never told me he loves me. And then she found out, she was 76, and this was a long time later, she was found out she was going to die of cancer in 3 to 6 months. So, my sister came in, and I do this my way. I want to tell the story, so I'm going to be okay.
Take your time.
I was really happy about this happening, but my sister was coming in, my dad, and I rode out to the airport to pick her up. And I said, you know, Dad, Mother told me that you never said you loved her. And he said, well, how could she think that? And I said, I've been there, and he gave examples, you know, what he's done for her. And I said, well, sometimes you just, maybe people just want to hear it. And just a few days later, my mother said to me, you know, she's still in the hospital. She said to me, I can't understand your dad. He's telling me he loves me. And he's still alive. He's 94. He's been widowed for 20 years. And he's,
I bet
he tells us that he loves us about every time we see him. So, you know, he kind of learned. I think he reconciled with somebody who couldn't express it. I'm so emotional, I don't know how he could be that way.
For many years, my daughter and I lived in conflict because, unfortunately, she's made out of the same cookie cutter I am. Two personalities, you know, and especially mother and daughter, there's always a conflict all the way from junior high on up through. And she had a very strong personality. She never really liked to walk in my shadow, except she looked like me. She had the same characteristics I did, and she just hated me because she wanted to be her own person, and she didn't want to be me. I, you know, there isn't very much anybody can do to solve this problem. And so we were never on real friendly terms. She was always, her dad was the one that made peace, and she went to him for everything, and he came to me with what she had asked him, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, about, it was 14 years ago. How shall I frame this? 14 years ago, I took a teaching position in Germany, and I had left before my husband had, because he had to finish out the semester at the college he was teaching at before he joined me. And our daughter at that time was at home. She had been divorced. She was at home. And he was going to drive her out to California to live with our son. And interesting. He said on the way out, as they drove cross country, he said, at times I had to look at her to make sure it was her and it wasn't you. I mean, that's how great the similarities were. Okay, so time passes about a year later. It was right after Christmas, and she called. We were in Germany, and she was in California. And she's jabbering on and on about her latest love life and the girl stuff between her and I. And her dad, being an engineer and always looking at the clock and wondering, oh, this is costing her a mint. Don't talk so long, you know, hang up, hang up. And she wasn't about to hang up. And just somewhere in the conversation, she stopped. And she said, you know, Mom, the older I get, the more I realize I want you. I mean, and I felt like going, yahoo, you know, I told you something. I did. I was really cool. I said, how do you feel about that? She says, I feel great. Acceptable. 14 days later, she died on her motorcycle.
Oh, my God.
And there was a reconciliation between her and I. I don't know how it came about, how she came to this point. I have no idea. But today I can live with that death, that I can live with that loss, because she had reconciled herself with me. It's a beautiful, beautiful gift.
From the daughter's viewpoint, my mother and I didn't. I was busy trying to prove that I was not her, and making a lot of different choices than she would have made. And at one point, that meant that I had to cut off my contact with her completely for a year. And when I decided I didn't want that to go on forever, I called her and asked her if she would come out to the West Coast and do 4 days of intensive therapy with me and the therapist that I'd been working with for a couple of years. And she came. And that was a real testimony to me of what love is about. And we made a lot of progress there, but I think the thing that helped us really fully reconcile was her dying process. She died a couple years ago. And as she came to accept her death, she became more accepting of everything. And she accepted me too.
It's beautiful.
I can say that from my daughter's standpoint too. I was daddy's spoiled, rotten little girl, and mommy hated me. It wasn't just my thoughts, it was true. She was very jealous of me, and it was seen by other family members and voiced later in my life that nobody knew what to do. And so I always grew up, no matter what I did, it wasn't good enough. It wasn't right enough. I was never perfect. When I became diabetic, I was her. I was her handicapped, deformed child. I was her failure. And for many years, there was so much. I always tried to win her approval, and I never could. And finally, I said, to hell with it, if you'll excuse my language. And I just said, if she can't accept me how I am, then I don't want her in my life. There was a long time that we didn't speak. My mother now lives about a block away from me. And we started going down to Channel 9, local. Some people from Seattle would know. It's a
public television
to answer phones. And we started doing this with a sorority of mom too, and mom started coming too. And then we started doing it, just the two of us, during the summer. And we were driving down I-5 one day, and she said, I always heard what you were saying wrong. And you always heard what I was saying wrong. You know, what you were hearing isn't what I meant. And I am so sorry I hurt you. And before that, Mom and I had started healing. But I think that was the really final shaking, you know, that really brought us together. You know, she said she tried to make me perfect, and she couldn't, and she wanted to be perfect. And things that she said, I didn't understand. We came to the conclusion that I was thinking right and she was thinking left, or vice versa. And it was a real powerful, powerful healing. And what's the word we're using?
Reconciliation.
Reconciliation. Yeah. And my mom's still alive. I'm very thankful. But we never know. And I'm just real thankful for that reconciliation. I am no longer the daughter that she keeps.
I've been an AIDS volunteer for probably 15 years. And I also care for people with cancer. And I was called by one of my pastors to go and see Michael's wife, who had throat cancer and would probably not live out the year. And they had no church home. And I was asked, will you go and talk to them? And usually my way of getting into a life is through food. I'm a professional chef, and I can cook up a mean meal. and that was the way I got started with it. And anyway, right from the very beginning, the very first time we talked, she talked about what she wanted at her funeral. And her husband is there, and I'm there, and she's there. And we're talking about this like we're talking about Safeway. Mm-hmm. You know, just very ordinary conversation. And with very little emotion involved. And anyway, she... her disease finally took her, and Michael was left alone. And I felt from the very beginning that I was there more for Michael than I was for his wife. And we became very close. We've become very close friends. And I come from St. Francis Church in San Francisco. About 60% of our membership are gay. Michael and I and two others are the only straight men in the congregation. So we become good friends. And he hands me a little book one time called Affectionate Men. picture book, you know, very small, and it showed down through history men who have shown affection to each other without feeling sexually attracted. Mm-hmm. Miners, cowboys, in wartime, just all kinds of situations that come up where men find themselves together and find themselves loving each other, but not being in love with each other. And I had been looking for a way to describe how I felt for a long, long time. It's kind of strange that two straight men would exchange that. So it's reconciled, I guess, my feelings about men and my need to show affection. It's a good thing.
Martha Stewart would say that.
Hmm?
I'm sorry, Martha Stewart says it's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I love Martha.
Linda Breitek says it's a good, good thing.
That's right.
Without love, where would we be?
Well, everybody's been teasing me about my long trip from New Jersey to Holden. And I had good reasons for doing that. When I got on the bus in Philadelphia, I was not in good shape. And I really needed to come to Holden, though I didn't know what Holden was going to be. And when you're on the bus for that long, I was telling somebody today, you kind of, you know, there's like a kind of forced community that happens with people. And so one part of the trip from Philadelphia, I had met this woman who was French. And what do I know about the French? You know, hardly anything. So my brother was married to a French woman one time, so I knew her, but I didn't really know anything about French. And the only thing I could think of that I knew about the French was that people always say that the French are snotty, you know, that they're snooty, that they're, you know, mean, not nice, you know. But anyway, me and her talked a lot and winded up talking about faith, you know, because she was saying that, you know, where she lives, it's not popular to be, you know, Christian, and that it's sort of like mystical stuff that nobody believes in anymore, and, you know, they're more secular, and, you know, like the church is more, you know, it's more the Catholic as an institution, but not, you know, that people don't really believe in it. So, I mean, that's very different than where I am, you know, that, you know, I really believe, and, you know, we started talking about that. But then she started talking about some of the things that she struggled with, like, you know, wanting to have a community and feeling like she didn't have, you know, some of the things that I think are provided for me by my faith. And so I started to, you know, respond to her in that way and say, well, you know, this is what being part of the church means for me. And, you know, well, maybe, you know, that's where you could find community. And maybe it wouldn't be in the Catholic Church, but are there other kinds of ways that you could, you know, connect with a community of faith and have these things? So, you know, I think that, you know, she started to consider some of the things that I was saying. But anyway, by the time she got off, we were in Chicago, and I had fell asleep, and I lost my glasses. It's dark, it's night. And so anyway, when she gets ready to get off, at the same time is when I had lost my glasses. And I'm like really panicking because I can't find my glasses. And I'm going to hold it, and I know I'm not going to be able to get any glasses. and I'm going to be blind the whole time I'm here. You know? So I'm like, you know, I wanted to say goodbye to her, but I was really preoccupied because I had lost my glasses. And I said to her, I can't find my glasses. And so I was looking for them, and then she got off the bus. But for some reason, I kept looking for the glasses, and she was finished, you know. She had gotten off, her trip was over. And it was like, you know, the bus was sitting there for whatever reasons, because I wasn't really paying attention to what they were doing. And I'm still looking for the glasses. This woman came back about 15 minutes later. And she comes back and gets back on the bus. And she says, did you find your glasses? And I said, no. And so she started looking for the glasses with me. And she found them. And she said, here's your glasses. And I just said, you know, thank you. And I mean, I just started crying. And we just hugged. And I said, you know, thank you for coming back. And thank you for caring that I had lost the glasses. I mean, and I didn't know what had made her come back. You know, because she was supposed to be gone, you know. And I just looked at that. I don't know if that's a story of reconciliation, but because the only thing that I knew about French people was they really didn't care, you know. And she showed that that was not the case at all. But she really cared about me.
I want to talk about one of the things that's been hard in my life is that I felt like reconciliation really couldn't happen without some kind of justice and or some sort of truth-telling. And for as much as I'm in, might have wanted at times to reach for reconciliation or a feeling of conclusion to a conflict, that I really couldn't manifest that without having gone through those other steps. And that was most evident for me in a situation that was dominated a lot of my life, which was an abuse situation in the church, which led me straight out of the church. Happened in my teens. And when I was 35, so 17 years after I'd left the church and really not participated in any sort of spiritual community at all. My 7-year-old daughter asked out of the blue, can we go to church? She probably heard about it at school or something like that. And I said, sure. You know, we can go to all kinds of churches. We could go to synagogue, we can go to the Bethany Booth temple up the street, and you know, so I sort of thought, well, we'll go window shopping. And but I decided to take her to the church of my previous faith because it was the one I was most familiar with in terms of the rituals. And she came up and said, I want to be in the choir, and I want to do this, I want to do that. And I thought, boy, now I've got real problems. And I had to do a lot of work to be able to make it possible, not just for her to go to church, but for this to be something that was, that we had some freedom around choosing. I never had an experience of reconciliation with my abuser. But I did have an experience of truth-telling in the institution that the abuse happened. And I did eventually have an experience of response on their part that, you know, in my own mind, in my fantasy of what reconciliation would or should look like the ritual that you're talking about is, you know, to me is, you know, like beautiful, perfect. This didn't come close to that. But what was true for me, ultimately, was that I had done everything I possibly could on my part. I had come all the way up to the line, and I didn't cross the line. I stayed with my part of it. I looked for the response. I got the response I could. And really surprisingly to me, I mean, almost miraculously to me, once that response came after a very arduous 2.5 year process of complaint and going through all kinds of stuff, I felt free. I had been going to church all this time with my daughter who wanted to be in the choir. but I found myself free to be there. Meaning, you know, not that I felt like I had to be there, but I felt free, like this is a place I could choose to be without a sense of, without a re-experience of violation every time I was there. So for me, I mean, just the piece I wanted to add to the conversation was this, I feel like there's a really strong necessity for justice and truth-telling in the process of reconciliation.
I have a kind of a redemption story, I guess. And I was thinking of it, Mona, when you were telling your story about the assumptions about other cultures. And I was raised in a very racist family. So Texas, long history of racism, not only against blacks, but against Mexicans and anyone who looked different. And that was the environment that I was raised in for many years. And I remember incidents. I remember the fifth grade being new in school and a Mexican girl being the first person who befriended me until the other kids kind of let me know that it wasn't okay to play with her. And I bought right into it. And I remember her spitting full in my face at one point, and not figuring out for years her anger or her fury at me and the betrayals that I did. And I remember so many other incidents growing up in which I participated in the racism, not really understanding. But slowly and eventually I had many wonderful mentors, teachers, and grace so that my attitudes changed considerably, so that the heart of my work began to be about justice and making justice and reconciliation. That became very important to me. And what the real redemption is in the next generation, my daughter, I mean, I remember my father saying, if I ever came home with a person of another race on a date, he would meet us at the door with a shotgun. I mean, it was that strong. And here, two generations later, my daughter's boyfriend is Filipino. My niece just married an African man who's living in Africa. The other niece is with a Korean man. And that two generations later, that this could happen, to me is truly redemption. That somehow we managed in my generation to say, okay, we're going to be dealing the rest of our lives with the racism that we've been brought up with, but somehow we managed to stop there, that it wasn't passed on to our children. And for that, I'm very proud of my siblings and my mother's influence, who wasn't as quite as caught into it. That's my story.
I'd like to share a story that kind of goes back to some what Mike was talking about earlier tonight, about compassion going out to the next circle, and what you were referring to, Charles, about reconciliation with the earth. We had bought our youngest daughter a rabbit, which is what she really, really wanted for Christmas. And as young children with pets often go, mom became, you know, the person who was supposed to take care of the rabbit. And what would happen is that the rabbit was in the backyard in a kind of a large and high cage. And when Sarah would go out there to play with it, she took it out of the cage and let it free in the yard, which had our vegetables and our garden. And so over time, I became the arch enemy. I could easily have been a caricature in, you know, a Peter Rabbit or something like that, because I had a huge salmon net, if those of you that know what a salmon net looks like, and I would be chasing the rabbit all over the backyard. It was ridiculous. Wah, 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 you know, trying to catch this rabbit, and the rabbit, whenever it saw me coming, would take off under the fence to the neighbor's yard and wait till I went away, and then it would come back into the yard. This went on for a very long time. And I felt a little bit bad, you know, to be the one that always wound up catching the rabbit and picking him up by his back and fur and putting him back in the cage. Not him, her, Rosie was her name. And we really, Rosie came to not like me at all. And so we did this kind of dance regularly. And then one fall, I went to a workshop with a Cherokee woman who was teaching a lot about reconciliation with the earth. And much of what she taught had to do with regard for all creatures as our relatives. And part of that was that she began to introduce me to what has become a strong thing in my life, which is sacred movement. And she taught a sacred dance in which all creatures are honored as connected. And it lasted for a week. It was a very deep influence in my life. I came home to my backyard and actually wasn't particularly thinking about Rosie. And I was in the backyard and I was doing this sacred dance when I felt something nibbling at my feet. And I looked down, and there was Rosie kind of sitting on my feet. And it was such a blessing that she offered me this reconciliation, because I had truly been her tormentor. And we then became really very good friends until she died in my arms about 2 years after that. And we managed to coexist in the garden. Became all right with me to share the vegetables with her. And she would come to me. And I really discovered how some attitude change, yeah, she knew it somehow.
Our time has drawn to a close, and perhaps Rosie has brought us back to where we began with Charles. As I mentioned in the beginning, there's a Compline prayer service in this room shortly, and so you may wish to stay and end the evening that way, or you may wish to go and take your ice cream dishes with you to the kitchen. But let's end with a time of prayer. Holy One, we thank you for guiding each of our steps this evening into this room, the way you've
weaved us together through the sharing of these stories. The way your spirit has been present in each story and connected us together. As we've heard about walking through nature and really paying attention to where we are and how the animals and even the plants, as Charles said, are praising you. We thank you for stories of reconciliation that included rituals and imagining how we could even go through painful things like divorce in a way that is a reconciling way. Thank you for stories that teach us that death is part of life and that we can even become reconciled to our own grief and through that open ourselves up to new life, the new life that you are always offering us. We thank you for stories that remind us that true reconciliation requires justice. We thank you for stories that tell us about family members reconciling after long, difficult relationships and learning the lesson that we need to be careful how we hear each other because we may be hearing something other than what that other person is saying. And we thank you for stories that remind us of the importance of telling each other that we love them. And especially that straight men who suffer more than anyone else perhaps under the burden of homophobia can actually open up and be close and tell each other that they love each other. And we thank you for stories about pets who are so important in our lives, often being mediators between the world of nature and our social world, who really are in relationship with us and help us to live longer and to live more calmly and perhaps more humbly. For all these stories and more, we thank you. Remind us that people who are different from us, even French people, are your children as we go off now into the village and continue to live in the grace that you give us. Amen.
Amen. Amen.